Hello and welcome to this podcast from Le Monde Diplomatique. My name is George Miller, and I'm pleased to say that the programme is back after a few months' break. I'm also delighted to say that my guest in the September 2012 edition of the podcast is making a return visit. Michael Clare is Professor of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College, Amherst, Massachusetts, and the author of many books, including Resource Wars, Blood and Oil, and most recently, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources, which was published by Metropolitan Books earlier this year. One reviewer said of it, "It feels like a guidebook to wars to come." Michael last appeared on the programme in January 2010, when he gave an interim assessment of Obama's foreign policy. I spoke to him this month about his article in the latest edition of Le Monde Diplomatique on China's growing need to seek its energy supplies from overseas. Michael's piece is entitled China's Imperial Predicament, that predicament being, how can China ensure stability at home when that stability depends on growth, which in turn demands resources, coal, oil, gas, iron, copper, among other commodities, in ever greater quantities each year. Now the demand far exceeds what's produced domestically, many of those resources have to be imported, often from countries which are, as Michael Clare puts it, unfriendly, unstable, or unreliable. And what is the quid pro quo when dealing with unsavoury regimes? Infrastructure projects that benefit the wider population, or military technology and training that consolidate power? When I spoke to him recently on the phone at his home in Massachusetts, I began by asking Michael Clare to outline China's resource-hungry predicament.
The overwhelming priority of China's leaders is to sustain economic growth. This is what the legitimacy of the Chinese leadership, the Chinese Communist Party, rests upon. They have to continually deliver economic growth to satisfy the aspirations of their population. And to do so, they need to provide more and more economic activity. And that means more resources, more raw materials for their industries and for their consumer goods, like automobiles. It used to be that they could satisfy their resource needs from domestic sources of supply, oil and coal and iron and copper and everything else. But now their demands are so vast, so great. China is the biggest consumer of most minerals and everything else, that it can't be satisfied with domestic supplies. So they have to go outside. They have to go abroad for raw materials. And this means forging relationships with resource-supplying countries, the oil states in the Middle East, mineral-providing states in Africa and Latin America, and so forth. And like many other empires before them, they find that this involves developing relationships with resource-supplying countries that are often not to their liking and that are fraught with all kinds of difficulty.
And as you say in your article, the accidents of geography and geology do indeed mean that they have to do business with regimes they might well prefer not to, regimes which are unstable or unreliable or in some way unsavory.
Yes, this is exactly what's happened to the United States. The United States is heavily dependent on imported oil, and because most of the remaining oil is concentrated in the Middle East and Africa, the U.S. has forged relations with very unsavory regimes, even hostile regimes in the Middle East, and this has led to tremendous trouble, including several wars. And China is now finding itself in the same predicament, where it's becoming dependent on the very same suppliers in the Middle East and Africa as the United States and France and Britain have in the past, and finding itself in the same trap where it has to forge these kind of relationships with unsavory and unstable and unpredictable regimes.
But at the same time, it's conscious of its own image, isn't it? If it can avoid it, it doesn't want to come across as an imperial superpower flexing its muscle throughout the globe.
Yes, China is very conscious of its image and likes to say that it's a developing country itself and is going to go, bend over backwards to demonstrate that it's not an imperial power, that it's not like the Western powers. And so it is providing development loans and all kinds of humanitarian assistance to the countries where it goes for its resource needs. But it can't help get out of the problem that it's in, which is that it's really going to those countries not to be a do-gooder, but to extract resources. So no matter how much good it does, it still gets trapped in its relationships with the dictators or the elites or the military regimes that govern those countries.
And you talk in the article about countries such as Sudan and Zimbabwe, where military training or military hardware has been part of the deal, hasn't it?
Yes, indeed. Now, again, this is nothing new. The Western powers, the United States and Great Britain and France, have been doing this for a very long time. Once they become ensnared in a relationship with these resource-providing governments, they want to help keep them in power, and so they provide those governments with military aid and police aid and training and equipment and intelligence support and all the rest. Now China finds itself in the same bind. Its partners in Africa and the Middle East, they want what the Western powers have been offering them. They want arms, they want military training, they want intelligence support and police assistance. And China has been very willing to provide them with those kinds of services.
And you talk in the article not only about deals done with foreign countries, but also Chinese acquisition of equity stakes in foreign businesses, especially extractive industries such as mining. I mean, there's a lot of talk in the Western media about China buying up the world. So, I mean, how seriously do you think we should take those claims that are sometimes made in the media?
Okay, well, to put this in perspective, Chinese ownership of equity, ownership of foreign mines and oil fields is still quite small compared to what American and British and French companies own. It's still a junior partner in most of these cases, so it shouldn't be over-exaggerated. On the other hand, China does have a policy called the go-out policy to try to acquire equity stakes in foreign resource corporations and resource enterprises around the world, and they're pursuing this very aggressively. But they do this, following the model set by the Western companies.
And when we look at the continent of Africa, it does seem as though there are winners and losers, both at the level of nation states, but also within nation states, where the trickle-down effect doesn't seem very pronounced, and it seems to be the case that business is done with regimes and with governing elites.
Indeed, this is the case in many places where China is doing business in Africa, where China forges a close relationship with the ruling elite in a resource-providing country. Like Angola is a good example. China has cultivated close ties with the Angolan leadership, Jose dos Santos, the president, and provided all kinds of assistance to the government. And that's a country where the ruling elite and the cronies of the president do very well, but most of the population still lives on less than $2 a day. And there doesn't seem to be any signs that all of the Chinese investment is leading to an improvement in the standard of living of ordinary people.
And back home in China, how critical would you say, Michael, that the reliability of supply of raw materials is to the political stability of the nation?
Everything is connected, and everything is governed by the central principle of keeping economic growth alive, keeping economic growth steady. And so supplying resources is only one part of that picture. It's also about generating export growth and building infrastructure. All of these things are interconnected, but of course, acquiring resources is one of the major aspects of Chinese economic and foreign policy, and it's kind of a nightmare for them because they're going to need more and more of it in a world where I believe the supply of resources is not expanding rapidly enough to satisfy the needs of China and India and the United States and Europe and Japan. So this is going to be a constant problem.
And of course, the resources you're talking about are of the non-renewable sort. They are finite resources. And the graph that you show in your article, the growth year on year of China's energy requirements is really quite sobering, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. The extractive industries say that they're going to be able to supply future needs of oil and natural gas and coal and uranium and copper and iron and all of the rest of these non-renewable resources. But I'm very skeptical of this because they're running into roadblocks that are a product of the fact that most of the easy sources of supply have now been depleted, and what's left are much more difficult to extract resources, like offshore, deep offshore, or Arctic resources. And these are much more expensive to produce and more difficult and more contested. So for China, like everybody else, this is going to be an increasing headache.
And finally, Michael, what signs are there that the Chinese leadership is beginning to turn its energy policy towards renewables and to take stock of the fact that not only are the resources it seeks finite, but they're also overseas and therefore always prone to unreliability? So are the signs in the five-year plan that really China does need to shift its energy policy in the long term?
Well, it's very clear that the senior Chinese leadership at the national level is aware of all these risks and is taking steps to move the economy in the direction of renewables and more advanced materials that don't require so much non-renewable raw material inputs, composite materials and all kinds of renewables. However, we learn about the Chinese economy and the way things run in China is that even though decisions may be made at the center in Beijing, they're not always carried out at the provincial level and the local level. And what's happening is that the preference for rapid growth often overtakes the directives coming from on high. So even though there's clear indication of leadership awareness of the problem, I'm not sure that the whole system is able to adjust in the way that's necessary.
I was talking to Michael Clare. You can read his article, China's Imperial Predicament, in the September issue of Le Monde Diplomatique. Do also visit Le Monde Diplomatique's website at mondediplo.com. There, subscribers can read the current issue of the paper and access a comprehensive archive, as well as exploring the Diplomatic Channel section, which offers articles, blogs, maps, images, and a podcast archive. I hope you'll join me again next month for another in-depth interview with one of our contributors. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.